From Washington, this is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, another shocking video from the Islamic State militants. Expert warning, the world is losing the Ebola fight. A million Somalis at risk of hunger, according to the UN, plus Russia troops spotted inside Ukraine. Hello, everyone. I'm Steve Norman. The Islamic State extremist group has released a video that appears to show the beheading of a second U.S. hostage journalist, Stephen Sotloff. U.S. State Department spokesperson Jennifer Psaki said Tuesday officials are checking into the authenticity of that video.
If the video is genuine, we are sickened by this brutal act taking the life of another innocent American citizen. Our hearts go out to the Sotloff family, and we will provide more information as it becomes available.
The images Tuesday followed the Islamic State's release of a video showing the gruesome beheading of U.S. freelance journalist James Foley last month. In this latest video, the killer addresses President Obama, saying Sotloff's death was in retaliation for U.S. airstrikes against the militants. Meantime, the U.S.-based Committee to Protect Journalists condemned the Sotloff apparent beheading. Robert Mahoney is CPJ's deputy director.
Journalists know that covering war is dangerous and that they could get killed in crossfire, and they can take steps to diminish those risks. But that's different from being dragged in front of a camera and butchered simply because you're a journalist. That's a crime, that's a war crime, and those that committed these crimes should be brought to justice.
CPJ says a number of other journalists still remain missing, and Mahoney said it does not appear that there is much that can be done to secure their release. The human rights organization Amnesty International is accusing the Islamic State militants of conducting a brutal campaign of ethnic cleansing throughout northern Iraq. VOA's Alpesin has our report.
Amnesty International says Islamic State fighters have conducted mass executions and abductions of members of ethnic and religious minorities and forced nearly a million people to flee their homes. The report is based on interviews with survivors of massacres and other refugees who have fled to Kurdish-held areas and some telephone calls with people trapped in areas controlled by the militants. Speaking via Skype from the Kurdish-controlled Iraqi city of Erbil, Amnesty's senior crisis response advisor Donatella Rovera told VOA the sweeping advance by Islamic State militants has changed the demographic map of northern Iraq in a horrifying way.
The Islamic State has been carrying out a very brutal campaign and has managed in the space of barely a few weeks to remove, ethnically cleanse the entire minority population, the ethnic and religious minorities, from the areas in northern Iraq that are now under the control of the Islamic State.
The militant Sunni Muslim group has targeted Shiite Muslims and a variety of small Islamic and Christian sects, some of which have been living in northern Iraq for centuries. The United States has been bombing Islamic State targets in support of Iraqi and Kurdish forces that are fighting it on the ground. But Rovera says recent gains made by Iraqi forces have only been possible because of the help of Shiite militias, whose reputation is not much better than the Islamic State fighters.
It is very worrying to see that the only way that the Iraqi central government armed forces are finding to bring protection to some vulnerable civilians is by teaming up and cooperating and working alongside brutal militias who are completely uncontrollable and who are very well known for many years for committing horrendous crimes themselves.
Amnesty International calls what's happening in northern Iraq ethnic cleansing on a historic scale. Rovera says the Islamic State is guilty of despicable crimes and of turning some rural areas of Iraq into blood-soaked killing fields. She says 850,000 people have fled the area and are in dire need of help and protection.
These people need everything because they left their home with only the clothes on their back. So they need food, they need shelter, they need medical care. And the international community has been extremely slow in responding.
Rivera says that has improved in recent days after the United Nations called the crisis its number one humanitarian emergency. But she reports very little aid has actually reached the refugees. Rivera says it's too soon to know whether the Iraqi, Kurdish, and U.S. military efforts will roll back the Islamic State's advance. But she says the group has demonstrated that it will not respond to other kinds of international pressure, making the question of how to end the brutality both crucial and, at least for now, impossible to answer. Al Pessin, VOA News, London.
Also in the news, President Obama is ordering another 350 U.S. military personnel to Iraq to protect American diplomats and facilities in Baghdad. The additional forces will take on a no-combat role, they say, but will be part of the president's commitment to provide necessary security to U.S. personnel. United States has been targeting Islamic State militants in Iraq with airstrikes. Mr. Obama has said the air action will continue to protect the American interest in Iraq from the militants.
News is mobile, and so are you. Get VOA on the go. Get VOA on Google Currents. Get VOA News specifically made for your tablet and smartphone. Clean, simple, fast. Now available for Android or Apple phones or tablets. Download the Google Currents app for free today. Get VOA on Google Currents at voanews.com/currents.
Four UN peacekeepers have been killed and 15 others wounded after the convoy they were traveling in struck a landmine in northern Mali. UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon condemned the attack, the latest in a series of incidents against UN personnel and contractors in recent weeks, including the one that wounded nine Chadian peacekeepers on August the 29th. Northern Mali fell under control of Tuareg separatists and then al-Qaeda-linked Islamist militants following a 2012 military coup. French-led intervention last year scattered the extremists, but some remain active and there have been continued bursts of violence. Government of Mali is in talks with Tuareg and Arab groups. Al-Qaeda is not participating in those discussions. International medical aid group Doctors Without Borders says the world is losing the battle against Ebola and warns the deadly virus will not be stopped unless wealthy nations dispatch specialized biological disaster response teams to West Africa. The organization's president, Dr. Joanne Liu, said Tuesday that her group, which has treated more than 1,000 Ebola patients in West Africa since March, is completely overwhelmed by the disease. Meantime, world leaders and heads of global health organizations gathered at the UN in New York Tuesday to discuss efforts to combat the deadly disease. Dr. Margaret Chan is the director general of the World Health Organization.
Let me say so up front. This is the largest and most severe and most complex Ebola outbreak ever seen in nearly 40 years' history of this disease. No one, even outbreak responders, would experience dating back to 1976 to 1995, have ever seen anything like it. As of this week, more than 3,500 cases are reported in Guinea, Sierra Leone, and Liberia, and more than 1,500 deaths. The outbreaks are racing ahead of the control efforts in these countries.
Dr. Chan also warned that Ebola has become a global threat which requires urgent global efforts. The WHO said last week that casualty figures may be up to four times higher than reported and that up to 20,000 people may have been affected by the outbreak by the time it ends. It launched a $490 million plan to contain the epidemic. During Tuesday's meeting, United Nations System Coordinator for the Ebola Crisis, David Abaro, spoke to reporters.
As Dr. Chan said, this global emergency requires an unusual coalition of actors. In my view, it's every country in the world needs to be thinking, what can we do to help? Because if we don't get on top of this outbreak as a global community, then this could affect all of us in unexpected ways. It's not somebody else's problem, it's our collective problem. So for building that unusual coalition of actors, we will establish totally unusual coordination mechanisms in the UN system, and they will be exceptional, and they will be designed to do what the world expects us to do. Because, as has been said by earlier speakers, we are all responsible, we are all accountable.
And the head of the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, Dr. Tom Frieden, back here in the U.S. from West Africa, where he saw firsthand the plight of the people who are dealing with the Ebola outbreak. He spoke Tuesday at the CDC headquarters in Atlanta.
The men, women, and children I met and spoke with, the healthcare workers who are responding, the people from within countries, the patients, the survivors, and relatives of those who've died, will always be with me. The bottom line is that despite tremendous efforts from the U.S. government, from CDC, from within countries, the number of cases continues to increase and is now increasing rapidly. And I'm afraid that over the next few weeks, those numbers are likely to increase further and significantly. There is a window of opportunity to tamp this down, but that window is closing. We need action now to scale up the response. We know how to stop Ebola. The challenge is to scale it up to the massive levels needed to stop this outbreak.
Dr. Frieden briefed President Obama Tuesday on the outbreak. Also Tuesday, Mr. Obama joined the fight against Ebola by recording a message for West Africans on how to avoid and treat the deadly disease. The World Food Program and the Food and Agriculture Organization of the UN are warning the Ebola epidemic in West Africa is likely to result in food shortages in the three most severely affected countries. They are Liberia, Sierra Leone, and Guinea. UN officials note that the main Ebola-affected countries have had adequate rain and were looking forward to a good harvest season. But a spokesperson for the World Food Program, Elizabeth Beers, tells VOA that quarantine zones aimed at combating the spread of the virus are curtailing the movement and marketing of food.
We can see that travel restriction, displacement have already affected prices because food producers are leaving their land to seek potentially safer area. The Ebola crisis has led to buying panic also and prices hikes, and also the ban on the consumption of traditional protein sources, particularly bush meat, may have implication for the food security and nutrition of the people in this community.
Main harvest season for two key crops, rice and maize, is just a few weeks away. UN agencies warn labor shortages on farms due to movement restrictions and migration to other areas will seriously impact farm production. Beer says the labor shortage also can be directly linked to Ebola. And the World and the Food Organization say more than 1 million Somalis are in need of humanitarian assistance, and at least 200,000 children under the age of 5 are acutely malnourished as drought hits southern and central parts of Somalia. Mohamed Youssef reports from the VOA East Africa Bureau.
The UN's Food and Nutrition Analysis Agency, FSNAU, warns that the humanitarian recovery and gains made 2 years ago may be lost as poor rains, a cycle of violence, and reduced aid assistance threaten the lives of millions of Somalis. Agency Chief Technical Advisor Daniel Mola says the people of southern and central Somalia need humanitarian assistance and livelihood support in the next 4 months as they wrestle with crop failure and conflict.
Our projection indicates that a combination of poor rainfall, increased cereal prices as a result of conflicts, but also because we had a poor, a below average harvest last year, and then a poor harvest prospect this year. So we now have over 1 million people that are acutely food insecure and need urgent humanitarian assistance until the end of the year.
The report also says more than 43,000 Somali children are at risk of dying from hunger, and one in seven under 5 years are acutely malnourished. In 2011, the UN declared famine in some regions of Somalia after more than a quarter of a million Somalis, mostly children, died of hunger. Mola calls on aid agencies and the international community to respond now before the situation worsens.
Although there is no imminent risk of famine now, but we should remember that even back in 2010-2011, half of the people, an estimated 260,000 people, died before famine was declared in July 2011. So we don't have to wait. Donors and the humanitarian community do not need to wait to a famine declaration to start respond.
Since the last crisis, Somali insurgent group Al-Shabaab has lost ground in the face of a concerted military push by African Union troops and Somali government forces. In some cases, the group has blocked roads to towns it lost in an effort to cut off incoming supplies. On Saturday, AU and Somali forces launched an offensive to take more ground from the group in areas it controls, especially the port town of Barawe, the insurgents' last remaining financial hub and the route used to ship weapons. Late Monday, US forces carried out an airstrike targeting Al-Shabaab commanders in the Lower Shabelle region as part of the effort to weaken the group's capabilities. Security observers hope that this time around, humanitarian agencies will be able to access more areas than in 2011, when the militant group controlled much of south and central Somalia, making the work of aid workers more difficult. Mohamed Yusuf for VOA News, Nairobi.
From the ordinary to the extraordinary, you never know what in the world will happen next.
The world is watching with grave concern as Russia has positioned its military.
You should not allow anyone to deprive you of your right to determine the future.
We are using this against terrorist groups coming from Turkey.
With a landing on
civilians. And sponsored by, no, we are not killing civilians.
All that's happening, VOA News works to keep you up to date every hour of every day. So when you want to know what's new, you know what to do. Tune in your radio or click on the internet. World News on the hour, every hour, or at your convenience at voanews.com.
A Ukrainian official said Tuesday that Russian troops have been spotted in 10 locations inside of eastern Ukraine, including the major cities of Donetsk and Luhansk. Also Tuesday, the Secretary General of the Council of Europe, Torbjörn Jagland, said the alleged presence of Russian troops in eastern Ukraine has been a clear violation of the country's territorial integrity.
Also, the principle of rule of law has been violated because under the in the statute of the Council of Europe, it is said that member states are obliged to find peaceful settlements of any conflict.
Jagland was speaking in Kiev at a joint press conference with Ukrainian Foreign Minister Pavlo Klimkin.
The main question is how can one proceed to a more peaceful development, de-escalation of the conflict, and finding a way of settle this conflict in a peaceful way and in accordance with the principles enshrined in the European Convention on Human Rights.
And Mr. Klimkin also spoke to reporters Tuesday in Kiev.
He
said the Russian Federation's actions during the last weeks and months are rude violations, his words, of its statute obligation and duties as a European Council member state. The United Nations Refugee Agency says the crisis in Ukraine could lead to regional instability. The UNHCR reports more than 250,000 people have fled fighting in Ukraine and are now displaced inside the country. Lisa Schlein reporting from the UNHCR headquarters in Geneva.
UN High Commissioner for Refugees Antonio Guterres warns the ongoing crisis in Ukraine will have devastating humanitarian consequences and could potentially destabilize Eastern Europe if it is not quickly stopped. The UNHCR reports intensified fighting in eastern Ukraine, in particular around Donetsk, Luhansk, and neighboring towns, is driving more people from their homes and increasing the need for humanitarian aid. The agency says the number of people displaced inside Ukraine has nearly doubled in the past 3 weeks to 260,000. But UNHCR Europe Bureau Director Vincent Cochetel says this is a low estimate because people tend to stay with relatives.
People don't see the benefit sometimes of registering with the local authorities because they don't receive automatically assistance. People sometimes fear that they could be enrolled in the Ukrainian army immediately when they arrive. That's for the male, so they don't want to register, some of them. And then some people fear that there could be some retaliation in case they return later on from where they fled from. So they don't want it to be known that they have left their cities.
Ukrainian authorities report 2.2 million people remain in conflict areas. UNHCR spokesman Adrian Edwards says the agency plans to conduct a fact-finding mission later this week if security allows.
Ongoing shelling has left people in conflict areas with limited access to food, water and other basic necessities. In Donetsk, Makivka and Golovka, the regional authorities estimate 20,000 people with disabilities and needing help. In Luhansk, residents have been without proper supplies of food and water, dealing with electricity shortages, communication problems for a month. Buildings and roads are severely damaged. These are impeding efforts to provide humanitarian aid.
The refugee agency says many internally displaced people quickly returned to areas they had fled after the Ukrainian government reestablished control of some towns in the Donetsk region in early July. The agency reports, since January, more than 120,000 Ukrainians have applied for refugee status or temporary asylum in Russia. It says more than 800,000 Ukrainians have entered Russia over the same period. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Leaders of the 28 NATO countries gathering for the first time in 2 years starting Thursday in Wales with an agenda very different from the one they had at their last summit. When NATO leaders last met in the U.S. city of Chicago, Afghanistan was at the top of their agenda, and Russia was considered a partner in addressing the issues there. This year, responding to Russia's annexation of Crimea and its invasion of eastern Ukraine will top the agenda. The alliance faces a changed world, according to NATO Secretary General Anders Fogh Rasmussen.
We are faced with the reality that Russia considers us an adversary, and we will adapt to that situation.
That means a greater NATO military presence in member countries near Russia, such as troops in Lithuania, and a new force designed to strike hard and fast in response to an attack on its members. But NATO has been clear that it won't go to war with Russia to protect non-members like Ukraine. Estonia is calling for NATO to establish a permanent base on its soil as President Obama is visiting there, the one-time Soviet satellite amid Baltic state worries about possible Russian aggression in the region. Estonia's President Tomas Hendrik Ilves, during a visit to Tuesday to Norway, said NATO should not have two-tier countries, those with permanent NATO bases and those without. He said that's a wrong signal to send to potential aggressors, and it would welcome NATO troops in Estonia. And in an interview, Estonian Prime Minister Taavi Roivas said his country is not looking for a massive NATO presence, but one that nonetheless makes its presence known.
We're not talking about tens of thousands of permanently stationed troops in our country anytime soon. This is not the goal. We are talking about clear and visible presence here.
Later today, President Obama will hold talks with Mr. Ilves and other leaders from the region. He is on a four-day European trip aimed at reassuring NATO allies of active U.S. support as regional tensions over Russia's role in Ukraine continue to rise.
Visit our website at voanews.com. That's where you'll find in-depth reports, related stories, videos, and more from our team of correspondents. Or take the news with you by downloading podcasts of your favorite VOA program. That's at voanews.com. Online news for a changing world.
A new low-cost rapid blood test for sickle cell anemia could someday save the lives of thousands of children in developing countries. Estimated 300,000 children are born with the genetic blood disorder each year in Africa alone. Harvard University researchers are describing the new blood test as one that will tell doctors within 12 minutes whether a child has the disorder. Researchers say more than 50% of children under the age of 5 die of complications of sickle cell disease. Many thanks, everyone, for joining us today for International Edition here on The Voice of America. It's always good to have you with us. We hope that you'll stay tuned. The latest world news is coming up shortly. For our director, Tracy Carter, and engineer, Jim Harmon, I'm Steve Norman in Washington. Have a great Wednesday.
This is Today in History. On September 3rd, 301, San Marino was founded, the territory having gained independence from the Roman Empire. An enclave in Italy, San Marino is one of the smallest nations in the world and the oldest existing republic. On this day in 1260, the Battle of Ain Jalut was fought between Islamic-led Mamluks of Egypt and the Mongols in Palestine. The Mongol defeat marked the end of the Mongol Empire's westward expansion. In 1777, the American flag was flown for the first time in battle during a Revolutionary War skirmish between Patriot General William Maxwell's forces and a combined British Hessian advanced guard in Maryland. Exactly 6 years later, in 1783, the American Revolution formally ended with the signing of the Treaty of Paris. On September 3, 1838, journalist, author, and human rights advocate Frederick Bailey made a dramatic escape from slavery, traveling north by train and boat from Baltimore, Maryland, to eventually settle in Bedford, Massachusetts. That's when the famed abolitionist took the name of Frederick Douglass. In 1939, Britain and France declared war on Nazi Germany 2 days after German troops invaded Poland. France followed suit several hours later, and both countries were soon joined by South Africa, New Zealand, Australia, and Canada. On September 3, 1976, the U.S. space probe Viking 2 landed on the surface of Mars and took the first close-up color photographs of our planetary neighbor. I'm Dave DeForest with VOA's Today in History.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Less than 3 years ago, on October 23, 2011, Libyans celebrated the country's liberation from longtime dictator Muammar Gaddafi. A broad coalition of groups composed of people from all walks of life banded together, disregarding regional, religious, tribal, ethnic, and political differences, to rid the nation of a brutal regime. After months of fighting and the loss of too many lives, a bright new future finally seemed within reach of the people of Libya. Unfortunately, it would not be that easy. Rival groups that had united to defeat a common enemy soon turned on each other and began to fight in earnest to further their narrow agendas. Still, despite the upheaval, the country seemed to be moving forward, holding general elections in July 2012 and another one in June 2014 for a new House of Representatives that was seated in August. Since May, the three-year-long upward spiral of violence escalated. In Benghazi, assassinations and attacks on government forces continued in the wake of former Libyan National Army commander Khalifa Haftar's attacks on Islamic extremists, which he then declared part of a broader campaign against all Islamists in Libya, whom he likened to flesh-eating microbes in a May 20th interview. In mid-July, rival militias began a battle for control of Tripoli International Airport. After 5 weeks of fighting, hundreds of deaths, and millions of dollars worth of damage to Libya's infrastructure, the Operation Dawn affiliates gained control of the airport. These Operation Dawn affiliates then proceeded to declare a new government, a move denounced by the country's official government. And the fighting continues. In a joint statement, the governments of the United States, France, Germany, Britain, and Italy strongly condemned the escalation of fighting and violence in and around Tripoli, Benghazi, and across Libya. The five countries called on all parties in Libya, including the government and all militias, to accept an immediate ceasefire, engage constructively in the democratic process, and to stop all activities that risk undermining it. "We support the efforts of the UN support mission in Libya in this regard," said the statement. We call on Libya's interim government and the elected House of Representatives to adopt inclusive policies that benefit all Libyans and to build a government that meets the Libyan people's needs for security, reconciliation, and prosperity. We encourage the Constitutional Drafting Assembly to immediately pursue the drafting of a document that enshrines and protects the rights of all Libyans. Further, we encourage the international community to support Libya's elected institutions.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.